Good afternoon, and thanks for that introduction. Thanks also to Nick and Seamus for inviting me. I'm a great admirer of this organisation, a great centre of common sense in all sorts of ways, and I've benefited a lot from Seamus's common sense over the years. Today is a 200th anniversary. I wonder who in this room knows who was born 200 years ago. One person. One of the most important people, arguably, in the history of these Isles.
Ada Lovelace.
Ada Lovelace is essentially the inventor of the computer. And in the it's a recent best-selling book by Walter Isaacson, which goes through the history of all the people who created the digital world, it starts with a wonderful chapter on Ada Lovelace, who not only essentially sort of invented the ideas of computing, she was, of course, a woman, and proved that not all geeks are men, was immensely stylish, which is, again, not always true of geeks. And perhaps echoing what Kelly said, although she had great ideas, they took about 150 years, really, to come to fruition. And often with innovation, you do need a bit of patience and risk management, because not everything is straightforward. What I'm going to talk about a bit is... really picks up on what's already been said, but perhaps first a word on Nesta. When I was last in Belfast in the summer, I bumped into someone I didn't know who said, "Ah, you're from Nesta. They're the people behind Zombies Run." And it is indeed true that we gave a tiny grant to a thing called Zombies Run, which is an app which helps you if you're jogging and gives you the impression you're being chased by zombies. And it's a kind of nudge thing. I mean, it helps you run better. I've never actually used it. But that's actually not probably the most sort of typical example of what we do. So as you just heard, we're involved in quite a few different fields. We have a whole strand on research, and I'll share a bit of that. We have various investment funds, both purely commercial and impact investment. We have our own labs, actually, including now quite a large health lab, mainly working with the NHS, and we support innovation skills. And we've gone fairly global. We have teams now in India, China, just opened a US subsidiary, South America, and so on. But we're still, I guess, everything I will tell you is a bit provisional, because one of the things about innovation is it's not a science, really. It is a craft, and it's a craft which changes quite a lot. So you should always be sceptical of anyone who talks about innovation, because a fairly high proportion of what they say isn't quite true. And we can that's why we have a Q&A later where you can challenge me. I'm really going to make sort of two main points this afternoon. One is this one. I can't remember who first said this thing about many things being 5% inspiration, 95% perspiration. But I think even more in all the fields which we work on, the balance is something like that. You definitely need the creative spark, the great ideas. But I get totally fed up with people who think that's the main job of innovation. Far more important is the work of actually implementing things, refining them. Far more important is actually taking other people's ideas, adapting them, shaping them, and so on. And there's a very misleading view of innovation often as all about out-of-the-box, wild creativity. And that's simply not the case. And even the great icons like Steve Jobs, when you look at what they actually did, he was brilliant at stealing other people's ideas and just making them a little bit better. There's almost nothing he did which was genuinely original. And I don't make that a criticism. I mean that more as a lesson. And the other main thing I want to talk about, I'm going to give five, eight minutes each talking a bit about business, innovation in the private sector and job creation. Because as Kelly said, you know, this Northern Ireland needs to further strengthen the private sector, balance the economy. I'll talk a bit about the public sector, and I'll talk a bit about civil society. But I think the main thing I want to emphasise is the discussions in each of those fields about innovation are becoming almost the same discussion. They're not separate as they used to be. They're using the same language, some of the same methods, some of the same ideas, and I'm increasingly struck how a sort of younger age group, under 25s, under 30s, don't really see that much difference between innovation and entrepreneurship in a small business startup or a social enterprise or within a bit of government. Anyway, you can challenge that if you think it's untrue, but that's what I'll try and say. So starting off a bit with business innovation in the private sector. This guy is Paul Krugman, a Nobel Prize winner, who writes a weekly column in the New York Times. And he at one point said, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run it is almost everything. Almost everything about economic growth comes from productivity increase, and innovation plays an absolutely central role in driving up productivity. This is the sort of typical pattern in the UK, that if you look at where growth comes from, some of it comes from improving labour quality, skills, some of it comes from capital, but most of it comes either directly or indirectly from innovation. If you don't innovate, and that means both the new ideas and the adoption of other people's new ideas, your economy stagnates, you don't create jobs, you don't create wealth. But I would say exactly the same is true of the public sector, although we don't quite have the data to prove it. If you don't innovate in the public sector, and certainly if you don't have lots more money to throw in, then you will stagnate. And people will experience not just flat services, but actually worsening services over time. So almost everything I'm going to talk about is in some ways about productivity and about how you mobilise more innovation to increase it. In the private sector, not only do we know that firms that innovate do better, they're also absolutely critical for creating jobs. So this is the UK-wide picture. Usually about 5 or 6% of firms are creating more than half of all new jobs, and those tend to be the most innovative firms. So a big challenge of policy for any city, any region, any nation, is how do you really help that small number grow as fast as possible? How do you remove the barriers to them? And there's actually not much point in just trying to support everyone equally, because I'm afraid it's the nature of a market economy, much of the dynamism will come from a relatively small number. Now, you've got a lot of those sort of unicorns or fast-growing firms now in Northern Ireland, and the new thing a couple of weeks ago, the Google PwC partnership, is I think a good sign of that kind of dynamism, but there's still not enough. And that's where I want to sort of say a little bit about what's changing in how sort of thinking about innovation happens. And people like Owen know this very well. You know, in a way, all over the world, we're moving from an idea where innovation was all about places like this. This is Bell Labs, which is where the microchip came from and all sorts of other innovations. There was an idea that innovation meant big centres, big laboratories, big business, big government, huge complexes full of mainly men in white coats, high security, the sort of things which appear in James Bond films. And what you had to do as a government was pour lots of money into them, and sort of out the other side would come nanotechnologies and, you know, high super speed planes, etc. What's instead happened in business is actually a very different way of thinking about innovation, which is as much about users being involved in designing things like bikes or clothes. I came here on EasyJet. EasyJet has done no technology innovation, but it has innovated a lot in how you run services. There's open source. More than half the technology of the internet is open source. That means it doesn't have ownership. There's design-led innovation. Again, Apple's done very little classic R&D. There's open innovation, where companies draw on the brain power of anybody. And there's social innovation, which I'll talk a bit about later. And there's things like makerspaces. We've mapped the makerspaces all over the UK recently and are just doing one for China. These are the places where people are almost getting back to making furniture or technology or metal and making that a much more open, democratic sort of process. So this is all in some ways a world away from sort of the classic world of technology. And you see this in business in terms of where the money goes. Only quite a small proportion of what business spends on innovation is classic R&D. More of it is things like design or organisational innovation or training or software. And this is probably obvious to anyone in civil society. But in some ways, sort of business is learning things which might have been obvious to other sectors. And the policymakers responsible for innovation are having to respond to that too. And so we're seeing policy shift from just being about subsidising research, just technology transfer out of places like science parks, just venture capital, all of these remain important. And indeed, in many countries, more money is going into these things, but it's also being joined by all these sort of things, like business accelerators. As Kelly said, the use of procurement, public procurement, much more strategically used to drive innovation. The new Australian innovation strategy its new Prime Minister launched last week had helping kids code and program at the heart of the innovation strategy. Not universities, but primary schools. Networking. Prizes. We run a thing called the Longitude Prize and various other challenge prizes as a method of funding innovation. And how do you change whole systems? You know, if Belfast or Derry is going to move on to driverless cars, how do you, in tandem, as it were, you know, change the vehicles, the traffic systems, all the regulations? You've got to think much more systemically than perhaps in the past. So these are some of the new directions, and they're not that different from some of what's happening in terms of, I'll show the public sector or civil society. I'm going to go through this very quickly. One of the things we're a bit obsessed with is that no one in the UK knows where the money goes. That's to say, we spend billions on innovation, but without actually the best data tools for tracking where it goes, which places, which companies, which sectors. And one of the things we've been doing a lot of experiment on is new data tools, and data is all over here, to help make innovation policy much more data-driven. And later this year, I hope we will be sharing a sort of dashboard for innovation policy. We're doing a trial of it in Wales, and we would love to involve Northern Ireland in this because we think this whole field, oddly, was paradoxically, hasn't been making enough use of the best techniques for understanding what is or isn't working. I just thought I'd show this, because I only saw it yesterday, because I mentioned networking. This is the main Finnish innovation agency, which is increasingly mapping who talks to who is helpful to who. The sort of the social dimension of the economy is becoming much more prominent in the way these sort of agencies work. They're seen as probably about the best innovation agency in the world, and they're using these sort of mapping things to see who's providing either funding or advice to other people. I don't know if something like this has been done in Northern Ireland, but it'd be interesting, as you can see here, Startup Sauna, which is, of course, the key, that everyone goes to saunas and shares ideas. We can't quite compete with that. And all over the world, you're seeing much more focus on both encouraging more startups, but crucially to a better quality of business startups and scale-ups. And a few weeks ago, we published a thing called the European Digital City Index, which was partly looking at how different cities were helping firms start up and then scale up, access to different kinds of capital, skill, procurement, etc. It also provides actually a toolkit for governments or cities as to what they could do to move up this kind of ranking. And I think I'll skip over. So I was going to say a little bit about countries. If you look around the world at who's doing well, there are some big countries which are innovative, like the US or Japan or Germany. I'm afraid the UK is slightly below the line there. And quite a lot of small countries doing well. And one of the really interesting things at the moment is how much of the best innovation and innovation and the fastest gains are coming from these smaller countries like Israel, Finland, Singapore, Taiwan, and so on. And if you're interested, early this year, we published a report looking at five of them, at how they were using their small size, their agility, to really drive innovation, to create the networks, the support, the special advantages. And obviously, there's a lot of relevance for places like Northern Ireland, which should be more nimble, more agile than lumbering countries like England or France and so on. And just to give you one example, Estonia, whose population is very similar to Northern Ireland, you know, they've created extraordinary online infrastructure. They're teaching coding to five-year-olds in their schools. They have this slightly weird culture. They inherited a lot of Soviet technology, but they brought it together with very Scandinavian ideas. And they did an extraordinary thing last year, which is they've now enabled anyone anywhere in the world to become an e-citizen of Estonia. So if any of you feel the urge to become an Estonian citizen, you can, which seemed a bit silly. And then last week, they offered people the chance to have notary services in Estonia. So if you're setting up a company here, you can actually get some of the legals done in Estonia free of charge. So it's an extraordinary move by a country today, the same size as you, deciding to completely leap beyond perhaps the stagnant big countries and think in a completely different way about how they could attract people in, gain advantage, etc. The public sector. So you've heard a lot about where the public sector is. As Seamus said, coming from where I am, your public sector, certainly you face some slowly shrinking budgets, but nothing like the sort of catastrophic declines there have been in Greece or Portugal or even parts of England. The city I live in, Luton in England, where the budget's probably about 50% down in our local council. So how to drive up productivity in services like the NHS, like job centres, like schools, and so on. And I think in terms of the health service, it's almost mad to think of just protecting the health service and therefore almost guaranteeing a slow decline. You have to think much more radically about how you can use the best of new tools to drive up performance, to reorganise things. I'm not going to talk in any detail about that, but if any of you work in the health service, in the summer, we published quite a big report on the NHS in 2030, which tried to show how the combination of genomics, new sort of peer-to-peer mutual support approaches, behavioural economics, the sort of nudge things you heard about a moment ago, and new digital technologies helping people self-care and help and care for each other, how that offered a very different vision of the NHS, much less hospital-based, but probably much more effective, which could square the gap between the money that will be available and the needs of health. The other answer all over the world, again, as you've been doing here, is creating innovation teams or labs, dedicated groups within government departments with the specific job of accelerating ideas, experiment, learning. Last year, we did a sort of study of what we call the iTeams around the world, funded mainly by Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York. And at a gathering which some of the team here came to in the summer, we had there's 300 of these around the world, all sharing experience of working either within a city, a regional, or a national government. And their ethos is in some ways much closer, again, to a small charity than to classic bureaucracy. So it's trying things out very fast and often very small. It's being very attuned to the real-life experience of perhaps an 83-year-old needing care for dementia or a teenager. A lot of emphasis on measurement and data, and only scaling then the things which actually work. And the whole spirit of these teams is very opposite to what I used to experience when I worked in Whitehall, where our ideal was a big, fat sort of strategy document of 300 pages, which tried to answer every question, and we'd work for a year on it. And the ethos of these teams is start practical. Learn by doing. Don't be afraid of things being very small to kick off. That's how you'll improve them, not endlessly refining the prose in a document which goes round and round for consultation. Not that that's what civil services do ever. And here's just a couple of little examples. So we've been doing a lot on data and savings, and Mastodon Sea, a company we help back, has shown even simple things like prescribing patterns for GPs. If you track who is prescribing generics and who isn't, and you make that visible, you can show dramatic savings for the NHS by helping people adopt essentially the lowest cost option rather than the easiest ones. And they've shown just for one set of conditions, savings in the billions. Last week, we launched a thing called MoveMaker, which has come out of a whole program on using open data in the public sector to drive innovations. And here we get a bit of the public sector to open up its data and then see who can make this useful. And this came out of a program on housing. And what this is a tool for social housing tenants to swap flats or houses, flats mainly. Very simple, very cheap. It couldn't have been done within the system. It had to kind of tap the ingenuity of the rest of society, but it's a way of solving problems in a much neater form. The other, I think, crucial sort of part of handling savings is new ways of mobilising people. And for the last few years, funded by the government in London, we've been running a thing called the Centre for Social Action, which has been trying to find, fund, and then scale ways of mobilising public time and energy, volunteers of different kinds, to improve performance in public services. And they're in schools, prisons, all sorts of things. Here you're going to see one of the examples from hospitals, where we worked with hospitals asking doctors and nurses what things they would like to see done but they couldn't do because they didn't have enough time, and then recruiting volunteers in a much more professional way through the normal recruitment processes to work alongside them. And the hospitals now, we've got 10 altogether, each have about 2,000 volunteers working in this way. Now that certainly does save some money. It's not sort of the volunteers replacing the professionals, they're still working alongside them, but it's a different way of thinking about the public service and its resources being as much about the community as what sits within the building. And we've just been trialling at the moment the Good Samaritan version with for 999 calls. So when you dial 999, if there's someone within the cell of the person you are, a volunteer can come faster than the ambulance service, perhaps to use a defibrillator, which may make the difference between life and death in the case of heart attacks. Now that's again mobilising public volunteers as a complement to the NHS, partly to save money, but more to actually improve the quality of the service. In all of this, evidence is really important, and we help host a thing called the Alliance for Useful Evidence and the Evidence Exchange, which has been trying to help the UK exchange experience and learning. You'd have thought this happens all the time. It doesn't happen all the time. And my colleague Peter is in the room who helps run this. This is what the Cabinet Secretary said a couple of months ago. One of the things we ought to be doing more of with devolution is experimentation, but we don't do enough comparing and contrasting and learning. And so he was advocating more secondment, more exchanges and so on. And that's, I think, exactly the right spirit. We have now across the UK beginnings of a sort of evidence ecosystem, a whole series of what work centres you can see there, much more emphasis on use of evidence by local, national government, and much more systematic generation of evidence by universities and so on. And our hope is Northern Ireland is going to become very much an active player in this, possibly with a what works centre here. Because the only point of doing innovation is if it works. And lots of innovations don't work. And there's no point in picking up ideas which seem good if they don't actually work. And I'm just going to finally say a few minutes about the social innovation part of all of this, which is perhaps sort of closer to sort of classic NICFA territory. We have lots of people meeting in Paris still, talking about climate change. We have huge challenges like ageing right across Europe, very chronic long-term unemployment. And it's kind of obvious that you need innovation to solve these, particularly ones like climate change, where no one's ever been there before. No one's ever been in the situation of dramatically ageing populations before. These are new challenges, so they're almost bound to need new solutions. And I think 10, 15 years ago, social innovation was just probably words and didn't have much action linked to it. What's been interesting in really just the last 10 years is all over the world, in slightly different ways, the creation of institutions to do social innovation much more systematically, rigorously, just as we expect innovation to be done in business or technology. So you've got not just science parks, but there are now social innovation parks, creating zones of cities to be clusters of social innovation. Cardiff is doing this in Wales at the moment. There are social innovation exchanges, sharing methods. There was a big gathering in Mumbai, I was at a few weeks ago, of people working on city innovations in very poor cities, sharing methods. There are social innovation funds. A lot of governments have created funds to back innovations, Hong Kong, France, Australia. Lots of incubators. President Obama has an office of social innovation. There are mayors focused on this. The mayor of Seoul in Korea is probably the most prominent one. But the mayor of Malmo in Sweden is defining herself as a social innovation mayor. And they are having an enormous influx of refugees into Malmo at the moment, more per head of population than anywhere else in Europe. And that's creating huge challenges for how they handle housing or jobs or health. So there's a desperate need for innovation. There are prizes, there are intermediaries, new financing tools, and business increasingly running its own social innovation programs, a generation on from classic corporate social responsibility. Now, in all of these cases, I think it took them quite a long time to move from rather general words into action, but all of these are basically doing things. They're looking for great ideas, they're helping to back them, nurture them, and spread them. And interestingly, the dividing lines between the sectors become a bit blurred in all of their work. And nearly all of these will often be backing NGOs or charities, but sometimes they'll be backing for-profit companies or parts of a city government or a national government as well. What's important is what they do more than where they come from. And that's going to give two sets of examples of that before I shut up. So one is parks. Do any of you work on parks? Do any of you walk in parks? Probably lots of you. So I rather like parks. In England, parks face probably about a 60% budget cut in the next 10 years. That's the best prediction. And so we've been trying to help them rethink how do you run a park with half as much money. And we've been funding a series of experiments across England with mainly money from the Heritage Lottery Fund to do that. And it's really about new sort of business models. How do you run a park generating new revenue from use for music or food or activities? How do you bring in the public, perhaps as co-owners of the park alongside the city? And there are lots of really good examples, but it's a field where without innovation, all we would see is parks slowly decaying and declining in a sadly miserable and depressing way. And then the other field is jobs. We've been very frustrated with the lack of organisation of innovation around jobs all over Europe and North America as well. And one of the things we've done is create a living map of jobs innovators around the world and tried to persuade governments to be as systematic in applying innovation methods to youth unemployment as they are in applying methods to things like nanotechnology. Not much success, but there's a lot of interesting examples. And this is just one which we support. Very simple one called Get My First Job, which is, again, a digital tool for helping link young people looking for apprentices and employers. And it reduces the time that takes by more than 50%. That saves a lot of money for the government. It improves outcomes for the employer and the young person. And it's one of many, many very practical, very simple innovations which just makes a labour market work better. My very final point perhaps links all these things together. Have any of you seen the forecasts of the next 10 or 20 years about which jobs will disappear? It's been a bit covered in some of the newspapers. This is one of the way the Economist summarised one piece of research, and that's a list of jobs, and that's the percentage probability they'll be gone by 2033 or something. So if you're a recreational therapist, you're fine. There's probably not many dentists in this room, are there? If you're a telemarketer, you'll be afraid. If you're an economist, be quite afraid. And so on. These may not be precisely right, but what is clear is we are going through a pretty dramatic sort of new wave of automation. I mean, Uber is taking over taxis and minicabs, but in a very few years, Uber will sack all of its drivers and replace them with driverless cars. And indeed, I put Uber driver as one of the ones down there. But the question which follows is how do you prepare young people now for the jobs which will remain after all of these? And in all of these analyses, the kind of jobs most likely to survive are ones with some creativity in them. Robots aren't very creative. Ones with social intelligence, the ability to work with other people and in teams. And interestingly, too, jobs with some dexterity, ability to make things and use your hands. I think the important point is really the challenge for any government or any civil society. How do we ensure our schools are actually preparing for this world and not for the world of now? And that means very different ways of thinking about curriculum and experience and so on. I could talk all day about that. I won't. I would just point out that for the OECD, who do these regular assessments of school performance, a thing called PISA, they think the future of PISA is collaborative problem solving. That the most important thing you need to instill in the next generation of young people is the ability to create, solve problems in teams with others. Which is pretty heartland territory, I'd have thought, for NICFA and everyone in this room. And again, that's where ideas which perhaps are more natural for civil society are now becoming core to business, core to education, core to public policy as well. And what probably were a few separate discussions and debates are maybe becoming more and more a single one. So very final point. In all of this, I guess when we look at innovation around the world, what's striking, what perhaps connects all these different things is mindset as much as policies and programs. And part of the mindset is a bit of optimism, not mad optimism, but if you don't have any optimism, it's quite hard to innovate, take risks, do all the things Kelly was talking about, and Seamus. So optimism matters. Openness is absolutely crucial, openness to experience. And every sector risks not being open. You know, it's just the nature of institutions and sectors. They tend to close in on themselves, be suspicious of ideas from outside. And a key marker of ability to innovate is the willingness to borrow, steal, adapt ideas from very different fields. The third one is perhaps surprising. It came out really clearly from our study on small countries and the small countries doing really well in innovation. And this was paranoia. Actually, this is where perhaps Seamus's burning platform comes in. It helps to be a bit scared. If you're really feeling comfortable, you probably won't innovate or take any risks. The reason Taiwan, Singapore, Finland, Estonia are doing so incredibly well is they're scared of their neighbours. They're scared that they don't have a God-given right to exist or to be prosperous. And I think a little bit of paranoia may be helpful. And that's why I started by mentioning Zombies Run. Zombies Run is a sort of app for the paranoid. I was just thinking this morning they should probably re-record it with Donald Trump's voice. Jog, imagining you're being chased by Donald Trump or something like that. And somewhere in this mix is, I think, the answer to how to turn the unavoidable pressures of austerity and squeeze into something positive. They don't have to be negative. But crucially, to think in that open way across sectors. So some of the ideas, the things being done in perhaps science parks or in business startups, adopt them into civil society and vice versa. That's where, you know, the energy to solve these problems will come from. Many thanks.